February is often known as a time of love. We have Valentine's Day during this month. That's often a theme that you see. I know my grandparents on my dad's side were married on Valentine's Day, and a lot of folks like to do that to commemorate that special day. So this month, we are going to take a look at love, but through a very different lens. I'm beginning a series entitled Scripture's Soap Opera. And we're going to be looking at the Old Testament book of Hosea. Now, I realize that a catchy title like that might pique the interest of some of our, shall I say, veterans among us. But some of our younger members might not understand the significance of that phrase. For those not familiar with it, the phrase soap opera, it speaks of a long-running radio or television series frequently characterized by melodrama, an ensemble cast, and sentimentality. I would emphasize the word melodrama in that definition. They are stories that either go day to day or week to week. And they got the name soap opera because many of the early ones were sponsored by soap companies, as these shows were targeted to reach housewives during the daytime hours. Now, the first program generally accepted as a soap opera first appeared on radio back in 1930. These have been around a long time. It was called Painted Dreams, and it premiered on WGN Radio in Chicago. The first daytime soap opera appeared in 1949. It was called These Are My Children. I'm not sure if that became All My Children or if it's a totally different story. It's hard to say. They're kind of like Hallmark movies. It's kind of the same plot. Yeah, okay. But for decades, soap operas were very popular in the United States. In 1976, Time magazine described America's daytime television as TV's richest market. More people were tuning in during the daytime hours, really, than any other time. And then they introduced the evening soap operas, the late 70s, early 80s, when the show Dallas came out. It rose to number 5 among all television shows in its first year of production. The next 2 years, it was number 1, and that climactic episode of Who Shot JR, I think for a long time, was the most watched television show for years, right? In 1983, 4 of the top 11 primetime shows were evening soaps. Dallas, Dynasty, Knott's Landing, Falcon Crest. I see a lot of guilty pleasure nods out there, yeah. Some of you remember those shows. In their heyday, soap operas were watched by 30 million Americans. It was probably more than that because there was a bit of a stigma attached to watching soap, so probably not everybody admitted that they were watching soap operas. Their estimates range as high as 70% of the American population watched soaps either during the day or in the evening. Now, with the introduction of cable TV and streaming services, a lot of these kind of fell by the wayside. Right now, there's only 4. Days of Our Lives, The Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, and General Hospital, if you're keeping score. But the article that I saw online listed 47 other soap operas that have come and gone during this time. All of these stories, and most of them are based on romance and love and breakups and all the drama that comes with those relationships, right? Nowadays, we aren't quite so tuned into soap operas. They've been replaced by what's called reality TV, right? I'm not sure how much reality is really in those shows, but yeah, that's what they call it anyway. And the story we're going to look at today, I think, would probably be a big hit on reality TV. I mean, I can hear it now. On the next episode on WeTV of The Preacher and the Prostitute. Boy, that would get people flocking to the screens, right? And you say, oh, come on, really? Well, if you're not familiar with that, you may not have heard of the prophet Hosea. So I'll begin with the historical circumstances behind this story. Book of Hosea is found in the Old Testament. It is the first of what is called the minor prophets. If you get to the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, right after that, you come across 12 that aren't quite so familiar. And they're called minor prophets not because they're insignificant, but because they're short. By comparison, they're very short with the minor or the major prophets. In fact, all 12 of these prophets could be contained in one scroll back in the old days, and so it was called the Book of the 12. But these are still inspired words of God sent to His people during this period of time, and they still speak to us today. One scholar argues that Hosea belongs first, not because it's chronologically first, but it's theologically complete. It says it embraces the great prophetic themes of covenant, judgment, and hope. It describes the personal relationship between Yahweh and the prophet more amply than it does than the other companions. This is the most autobiographical of the minor prophets. We see more of his life than we do any of the others. And his marriage and his family form a vital part of this unique message. Hosea begins, as many of the Old Testament prophets do, by introducing the situation in which they ministered. Hosea 1:1 says, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel." Now, don't worry, those names are not going to be on a test. You don't have to memorize them. But they do give us the time frame of when this took place. See, shortly after the death of King Solomon, when Israel was at its height, the nation split. Very similarly to the split of America at the time of the Civil War. You had the North and the South. The northern 10 tribes retained the name Israel. The southern 2 tribes took on the name Judah. That was the predominant tribe of the South. But the capital of the whole nation, Jerusalem, was located in Judah. And so the North had to come up with a new capital city, and they did so in the city of Samaria. That's where the kings of Israel ruled. But there was another problem. Not only was the capital Jerusalem in Judah, that's where the temple was. And God had told the Israelite people, "I don't want you just worshiping anywhere. I want you to worship at my temple in Jerusalem." And the kings of the northern kingdom were concerned that if their people went down to Jerusalem to worship, they may not come back. Similarly to the Berlin Wall that wasn't built to keep people out, it was built to keep people in. And the kings of Israel had that same concern. We don't want to lose people to the south. So what they did was they introduced places of worship in the north, but they weren't temples of Yahweh. They were idol temples, and they were adopting the practices of the Canaanite people around them. They were bowing down to these gods. They were sacrificing to these gods, and there was an awful lot of immorality that took place, a lot of cultic prostitution, even child sacrifice was not uncommon in those pagan rituals. And now the 10 tribes of the nation of Israel were involved in that kind of worship. Now, you might not think anything was wrong just to look at the nation. They were prosperous. There were times during their existence where they were very strong militarily. You've probably heard of King Ahab, his wife Jezebel. They're painted in very black terms in the Old Testament, but in ancient history, Ahab was a very successful military general. His dad, Omri, of whom the Bible pays very little attention, was a very adept charioteer, and they were very strong militarily. They were strong economically. So they were thinking everything is great, and God said, no, I see you're rotten to the core. And he raised up Hosea as his prophet to denounce what the people were doing. Hosea lived through the tragic final 25 years, or the final years of the northern kingdom. He mentions Jeroboam in that first verse. This is actually Jeroboam the second. After he reigned, there were six kings in the period of 25 years, four of whom were assassinated by their successors. One of them was captured in battle. In all of that time, there was only one king who saw his reign pass to his son. It was marked with violence, political intrigue, a lot of instability. Some of their enemies around them were growing stronger. Economically, they were in decline. Things were falling apart because they had turned away from God, and in doing so, they turned away from his blessings. Hosea prophesied from about 755 to 715 BC, which means he was around in 722 when Israel was finally defeated in battle. The capital city of Samaria was demolished. The Assyrians came in and took a lot of the people out and brought a lot of foreigners in to intermingle with the Israelites. And they became known as the Samaritans, after the city of Samaria. And the Jews viewed them as half-breeds because they were not pure Israelite. They had these other nationalities coming in. Hosea was an eyewitness to that taking place. He ministered in the same time period as Isaiah, Amos, and Micah, other Old Testament prophets. His name is actually Hosea. There's a second H in his name in Hebrew. Interestingly enough, that's also the name of the last king of Israel before it was finally defeated. For that reason, many translators drop the second H, so it's Hosea. But in the Hebrew, it's very similar to the name Yeshua, Joshua, which we would know in the New Testament as Jesus, Yahweh saves. Hosea's name is about salvation. And yet his story takes a very roundabout way to get there, as we're going to see. So next in the story, we see a heavenly command. This is where it gets personal. This is where we begin to see Hosea's story as it is used to dramatize what God is doing. In Hosea chapter 1, verse 2, when the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. Hosea's call came through God's command about whom he should marry. And this probably took place in his late teens or early 20s. He was a young man when this first took place. In the ancient world, marriages were often arranged by the parents of the bride and the groom, but this one was arranged by God himself. He told Hosea, "This is who I want you to marry." And what a woman she was. This is where the soap opera theme really starts. The NIV called her an adulterous wife. spoke of children of unfaithfulness. That's being kind. The Jerusalem Bible makes it a little more takes it more literally. It says, go marry a whore and get children with a whore, for the whole country itself has become nothing but a whore by abandoning Yahweh. It's pretty strong talk. God wanted to get his message across in very stark terms. Now, scholars have stepped in and said, you know, this doesn't really sound like God. I don't think God would tell his prophet to go and marry someone who is so unfaithful. That can't be right. And so they've come up with possible alternatives. You know, maybe Gomer was really okay at first, but later on became unfaithful. Maybe. Some say, well, actually none of this took place. It was just a story that Hosea is telling, kind of like a parable, you know. But it really didn't happen. Well, that's really stretching it. I mean, the scripture speaks in terms that are pretty literal. It actually names names of people, which parables don't. I think this really happened. And it very well may be that it's just as it is written. God told Hosea, I want you to marry this woman, and this is what she is, and this is what's going to happen. And here's why. I like what J. Vernon McGee writes. He says, I consider this a nice way to get God off the hook, but you don't have to help him get off the hook. He takes responsibility for this. You know, sometimes we think God needs our help, and he really doesn't. Just take it for what it says. God is telling Hosea, you go marry a woman of, shall we say, questionable morality. Right? Questionable faithfulness. And as we're going to see, there wasn't any question about her immorality. Prophets sometimes did strange things. You know, you go through Isaiah and Jeremiah, especially Ezekiel. Oh my. Ezekiel's just weird. I mean, that is a tough book to get through. And even the people at the time were like, what are you doing? Seriously? But it was all to make a point. But I don't know if we see anybody whose calling by God cost as much as Hosea. I mean, we really see someone whose heart is about to be ripped out, stomped on, and thrown away in order for God to make a point to his people. And that's the heavenly command. He's commanded to marry a prostitute because that's what God saw in Israel worshiping other gods. It's like committing spiritual adultery. They were prostituting themselves, sometimes very literally, in the worship of these other gods. Far from a marriage made in heaven, this is more like a marriage made in Hollywood. I mean, we would expect to see something like that in one of our reality shows today. Now the chapter continues with the story after he had taken this woman to be his wife. Verse 3, he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. I want you to notice something that's easy to pass by in verse 3. It says, Gomer bore him a son. When we get to the other children mentioned in this chapter, it doesn't say she bore him a son. I think that's significant. I think this first boy is the only child mentioned that was actually Hosea's. She bore him a son. And God directs Hosea to name the boy Jezreel. Literally, it means God scatters, but the significance of it was a place name. There was a valley called Jezreel. And in the history of Israel, there was a terrible slaughter that took place in the Valley of Jezreel. And God says there's even going to be a bigger slaughter coming up when I judge the people of Israel. So Hosea naming his son Jezreel, it'd be like somebody in the Confederate South naming a child Gettysburg. Or maybe somebody in post-World War II Japan naming a child Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Every time you say the name, the significance comes through. It's like naming a child Slaughterhouse. You say, wow, that's a tough one to go to school with, right? Oh, it gets worse. So we have this son who is predicting the slaughter of Israel in 722 BC when it will no longer be a nation. Then the story continues. Verse 6. Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Notice, no reference to Hosea. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel that I should at all forgive them. Yet I will show love to the house of Judah, and I will save them, not by bow, not by sword or battle, or by horses or horsemen, but by the Lord their God. Lo-Ruhamah doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, and in Hebrew it means not pitied, not loved. It's the same word that is found in Isaiah 49:15, can a woman forget her suckling child that she should have no compassion on it? That's the word. And God explains, I want you to call her unloved because I'm not going to love Israel anymore. I'm not going to show her any pity. I've been patient, I've been waiting, and my patience has come to an end. There will be no pity when the nation of Israel comes to its end in the Valley of Jezreel. So you've got slaughterhouse, and now you add unloved, unpitied. And then, verses 8 and 9, we see Gomer's third child. After she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, call him Lo-Ammi, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Lo am I in the Hebrew means not mine. You think he was bullied at school? Hey, not mine. Hey, unloved. Those are tough labels to carry around, aren't they? God is making a point. You are no longer my people. Not because I'm done with you, but because you're done with me. You have rejected me. You have rebelled against me. And the time is coming when I will not have pity on you anymore. You're going to be wiped out. You're going to be slaughtered. Just like that historic slaughter at Jezreel, it's going to be even worse. So here you have the happy family. The preacher and the prostitute. And there are three kids. The last two, if there's any resemblance to Hosea, it's purely coincidental, if you know what I mean. Right? All the makings of a soap opera, isn't it? You know, you have love and marriage and unfaithfulness and children and, you know, who's my daddy and all that kind of stuff going on. What on earth is God doing? Oh, he's making a point. Can you imagine Hosea introducing his children? Oh yeah, here's Slaughterhouse. Here's my daughter, unloved, and here's my boy, not mine. Real subtle there, Hosea. But again, God is speaking to his people. And he doesn't leave them without hope. As difficult and as negative as this conclusion or this chapter has been, it ends with a hopeful conclusion. There is hope, believe it or not, after all of this. It actually begins in verse 10. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In that place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," they will be called sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, "My people," and your sisters, "My loved one." Here, reversing the names. You know, that little girl that we call unloved, call her "my loved one." That boy that's called "not mine," you are mine. Jezreel, that slaughterhouse, that place of destruction and disaster and defeat, is going to be a great day. He's looking ahead to the future when there will be restoration. I included the first verse of chapter 2. It's one of those unfortunate chapter separations that was not there in the original writing of the book. It constitutes a restoration blessing based solely on the grace of God. Something by faith, not by the works of the people. Instead of scattered, instead of unloved, people who are not God's, they will come together as the loved children of the living God. Now, there are some who say this applies only to the nation of Israel. And one day God is going to bring back the Israelites into the land, and it's going to be His chosen people. But that's not what the New Testament teaches. The New Testament actually takes this very story and gives it a new application. Turn, if you would, to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9. Beginning in verse 22. Paul asks some rhetorical questions here. What if God, choosing to show His wrath and making His power known, bore with great patience the objects of His wrath, prepared for destruction? What if He did this to make the riches of His glory known to the objects of His mercy, whom He prepared in advance for glory, even us, whom He also called, catch this, not only of the Jews, but also of the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, "I will call them my people who are not my people. And I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And it will happen in the very place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' they will be called sons of the living God." Quoting right out of Hosea chapter 1. But what he's saying is this. All right, you Jews who think you alone are God's chosen people and everybody else in the world doesn't matter. God is going to take the people you say are not His and He's going to say they're mine. He's going to take the ones you don't think God can love and He's going to say they're my loved ones. In fact, they are my children. And that would have blown the minds of the Jews of the first century. Are you kidding? God can't accept Gentiles. We're the chosen people. Not so fast. And he goes back to prophet Hosea to make his point. Peter did the same thing. Over in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter is writing to Jewish and Gentile believers. These are Christians. And he says, "Once you were a people, you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you've received mercy." He's taken those last two children's names not pitied, not loved, not mine. He's saying, yeah, but now you are. You are God's people. You are loved by God. Jews and Gentiles together. You say, I don't think I can wrap my mind around. How is that possible? How can that be? Let's go back to Romans. Romans chapter 11. Paul uses an image that was very common in his day among the Jews. It was that of an olive tree. Olive trees are very plentiful in Israel. In fact, there was an olive tree, I think it may have just come down in the last couple years, but it dated all the way back to the first century. 2,000-year-old olive tree was still around. And the people of Israel identified with the olive tree. That became kind of a national symbol, kind of like the bald eagle is for the United States. So Paul takes that image of the olive tree, puts a little twist on it. Romans chapter 11, beginning in verse 17. If some of the branches have been broken off, and here he's speaking of natural branches, these are Jewish-born people. If they've been broken off, and you, though a wild olive shoot, have been grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing sap of the olive root. Who is this wild olive shoot? These are Gentiles. These are people who were not born into the Jewish nation, but God is grafting them in. And those of you that are familiar with horticulture, this really does work. You can take a branch of a different tree and graft it in, and it'll grow. It'll flourish. Becomes a part of that tree. Paul says, that's what God's doing with the Gentiles. He's grafting them in. And then he goes on. Do not boast over those branches. If you do, consider this. You do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. Granted. But they were broken off because of unbelief. Now we see why. Why were those natural branches broken off the tree? Because of unbelief. They didn't believe in God. They were not faithful to Him. But you were grafted in. You stand by faith. Do not be arrogant, but be afraid. For if God did not spare the natural branches, He will not spare you either. Down to verse 23. And if they do not persist in unbelief, they will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. So those Jewish folks that have been broken off because of unbelief, if they turn back to God, He'll graft them back in. So that's amazing. Yes, that is how God works. Sin detaches us from God, but by grace, He's willing to bring us back. We may have been separated from God's people, but when we return, He will accept us and He'll make us part of that tree once again. After all, if you were cut out of an olive tree that is wild by nature and contrary to nature were grafted into a cultivated olive tree, how much more readily will these, the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? Here we see the restoration of those who come to God by faith. What a plot twist, right? We weren't expecting that. You know, we're thinking, all right, Israel's like Gomer, and she's being unfaithful to God, and she's, you know, doing all these things, having children out of wedlock, and, you know, oh man, terrible, horrible. You know, this is God has got to judge them, right? God says, oh yeah, I'll take care of that. But even then, they're not so far out of the grace of God. The bottom line behind all of Scripture's soap opera here is grace that is greater than all our sin. And you're going to see all kinds of sin in the book of Hosea. Believe it or not, the story gets worse. You'll have to come back to catch that. Just like soap operas, right? But God's grace is greater. Maybe right now you're saying, you know, I can relate to those kids of Hosea. You know, I may not have a bad name like they do. I may have a bad reputation. I feel like God doesn't love me. I feel like God is against me. It seems like every time I turn around, he's, you know, hitting me down again. I really feel like I don't belong. I feel like God looks down at me and says, you're not mine. I don't want you. But let me assure you that regardless of what brought you to that place, God's love, God's grace, and God's mercy is greater than that. And he can overcome a bad name, a bad reputation, a bad past, and bring you back in to his family. You might say, there's no way that I could be considered a child of God. And God says, you watch me. You come to me by faith. You put your trust in me. And I will call you mine. And I will show you my love, my compassion, even my pity on the mess that you've made of your life. You might think you are a walking soap opera. You might think your story would make a great reality show on TV. Doesn't matter how big a mess you may have made for yourself, or maybe other people made it for you, God can rewrite the script. God can turn that story around and come up with a happy ending. But just like we talked about earlier, the Lord's Supper, it's something we must receive. Doesn't just happen automatically. Remember those branches that were broken off the tree? They were broken off because of unbelief. They rejected God. They rejected what God was offering. But when we, by faith, receive what God is offering, his grace and his love, his mercy, we're brought back into the family. And that's a plot twist we can live with.